ESPN Daily is presented by Supercuts, the smarter, easier way to get a haircut. It's not just any haircut. It's Supercuts.
Mark Vanarruwata, game two of what feels like the most dramatic series in the entire NBA postseason is tipping off tonight. We have the Brooklyn Nets looking to avenge their last second loss to the Boston Celtics in game one. But I actually brought you here to talk about a figure who is even more significant to the Nets than Kyrie Irving or Kevin Durant. Joseph Tsai, the owner of the team, took full control of the Nets more than 2.5 years ago in August 2019. I remember, Mark, NBA executives feeling ecstatic, like they had just won something enormous. So what was so thrilling about someone like Joe Tsai taking over an NBA team in the first place?
I think you have to remember the context of this is that basketball is enormous in China, right?
Mark Vanarruwata is an investigative reporter for ESPN.
And so Joe Tsai, here is this figure who owns a company named Alibaba. And if you haven't heard of Alibaba, it's like Amazon on steroids. That's what it's been compared to. It's a Chinese e-commerce company. It's enormous. It's involved in everything in the same way that Amazon is. And as the NBA has always sought to expand its growth in China, I think the league and others saw Tsai as this wonderful opportunity to increase the depth of the ownership.
And since Joe Tsai has entered that fraternity of NBA owners, Mark, how would you describe relations between the league and China?
Pretty cold. The reality is, within months of Tsai taking over, the league found itself basically in the middle of an international incident.
Houston Rockets GM Daryl Morey, China, and the NBA. It all started when Morey posted this now-deleted tweet reading, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong."
While relations between China and the U.S. were plummeting over trade issues and human rights issues in China, you had China taking them off of television effectively in protest over Morey's tweet and the NBA's reaction to it. As it relates to the sort of human rights issues and human rights questions, Tsai has been asked about this at one point in an interview by CNBC, and he basically said, well, I don't know, you'd have to be specific and more clear about what you're talking about.
You have to be specific on what human rights abuse you're talking about, because the China that I see, the large number of the population, I'm talking about 80, 90% of the population, are very, very happy with the fact that their lives are improving every year.
So the reason we were really interested in Joe Tsai is because as the issue arose around the tensions between the league and China, Tsai was the personification of this conflict. Here's a guy who has these huge connections to China, huge beliefs in China's ability to be a major force. At the same time, the NBA is making billions of dollars there while trying to work with an authoritarian government and sort of avoid the kinds of human rights issues that they're addressing often here at home.
The National Basketball Association is in the middle of an intricate $5 billion dance with the Chinese government. And toes are getting stepped on, personally and politically, from New York to Shanghai. But to understand each move, you really need to understand one man in particular, Brooklyn Nets owner Joseph Tsai. So today, we investigate how Joe Tsai and the NBA are attempting to very carefully tread around issues like free speech and human rights, and what the true cost of doing business in China might be. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Wednesday, April 20th. This is ESPN Daily. Mark Vanarruwata, the Brooklyn Nets, they're just one small part of the vast holdings in the portfolio of billionaire Joe Tsai. And I want to know more about him. Where is he from?
Tsai actually was born in Taiwan, but his parents were from the mainland. They fled mainland China in 1948 amidst the communist takeover. He's actually a Canadian naturalized citizen. His parents ended up living in Canada at one point, but he very much identifies himself as Chinese. You know, this is a distinction for him that transcends borders or nationality. His father was a quite successful lawyer, and Tsai was sent to the U.S. at the age of 13. He knew no English at that point. He spoke Mandarin solely. The parents sent him to a private high school in New Jersey, where, you know, I think one of the main ways he adjusted was through sports, actually. He played football and he played lacrosse. He goes to Yale, and he has said subsequently in interviews that sort of his transition to America was aided considerably by his exposure to sports.
Something that was really the height of the sort of my career athletically at Yale was going to Georgetown. It was an away game, and I scored my first and only and last goal of my entire college career. And that was kind of the crowning achievement of my time at Yale lacrosse.
He also goes to Yale Law. He thought he was going to be a lawyer like his dad. He moves into private equity. He seemingly is sort of on that path. Sports are not a part of his life other than as something that he's interested in participating in.
So if sports are a sincere passion of his, but not his actual sort of business path at first, at least, Mark, how did he build his fortune?
So in 1999, he gets introduced to this guy named Jack Ma. And Jack Ma is the founder of this company, Alibaba. And at the time, it's a nothing company. It exists in a small apartment. Tsai, though, is really moved by meeting Ma. Ma is this just unbelievably charismatic figure. So charismatic that Tsai describes him as somebody sort of out of a kung fu novel. And he's so moved by this that he basically dumps his $700,000 a year job in private equity to follow Ma's vision. And he becomes his right-hand man and his alter ego in creating this company. And the company turns into one of the largest e-commerce companies in the world, if not the largest. It's bigger than Walmart. It's bigger than Amazon. And they're into everything from cloud computing to entertainment. You name it, they're sort of part of it. Tsai is now, as a result of that, the 254th richest person in the world. So Alibaba, this Chinese-based company, is the reason that Tsai became a billionaire, and it's the reason he was able to buy the Nets.
Yeah, I mean, just to pause here for a second, bigger than Walmart, bigger than Amazon, is sort of head-spinning, Mark. And so when this guy goes and wants to buy, you know, an NBA team, I imagine he can pay full freight, but it seems like he actually got a deal in retrospect when he bought his first share in the Nets.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, it's so hard to sort of comprehend a deal, but first he buys in a minority share of the company. He buys, I think, 49% from the Russian owner, Mikhail Prokhorov, at the time. But the plan is to buy full control, and he ultimately does that at the bargain basement price of $2.35 billion. He also, with that, buys Barclays Center and some affiliates, too. And I think the total cost on the whole deal is about $3.3 billion. And he ends up owning the WNBA's Liberty team, an esports team affiliated with Brooklyn. And then he's also using his money to get into purchasing investments in lacrosse teams and a lacrosse league and Major League Soccer.
So those are some of Tsai's investments here in the U.S., Mark, but as for the relationship between Tsai and Alibaba, the company that is, again, bigger than Amazon, that he co-founded, and also the Chinese government, what did you report about that relationship?
One of the things we learned during the reporting is that China's involvement in companies, while there's oversight in the same way there is in the U.S. or other countries, the Chinese government holds considerable sway over companies, and especially has really tried to emphasize control over tech companies. The other piece of this is that China has been working considerably to grow its artificial intelligence capabilities. They're in competition with the U.S. and other companies to try and have the most superior artificial intelligence entities. To that end, there are four companies that they've enlisted as their AI dragons. Two of those companies are companies that were funded considerably by Alibaba, undersized leadership, two businesses called Megvii and SenseTime.
And those two artificial intelligence companies that Alibaba invested in, Mark, Megvii and SenseTime, they've recently come under intense international scrutiny. Why is that?
Not one, not some, but every single provision in the United Nations Genocide Convention violated by the Chinese government's treatment of Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities in Xinjiang.
The U.S. government had identified these companies and several others and put them on what's called an entity list. And the entity list basically said any of these companies are effectively acting contrary to the national security or foreign policy interests of the U.S. China has, of course, disavowed this notion and argues that this is not the case and that these are being used for security purposes and to help develop a successful AI program.
So, Mark, as all of this is proceeding in China, when do we see the NBA directly become connected to this story?
As the NBA sought to expand its growth in China and effectively find another Yao Ming, you know, the superstar player from China who came and was highly successful player with the Rockets, they created these training academies there in partnership with the Chinese government. One of those academies was based in Xinjiang, where Uyghur Muslims are being profiled. And so as we reported on that, we found that in addition to abuses going on at the various academies in Xinjiang, you had coaches describing to us how they'd been detained. One coach said he'd been detained three times. He ended up comparing to the atmosphere to World War II Germany. You had this surveillance state that these coaches were experiencing through the use of effectively the AI that Alibaba had invested in, as well as other businesses that were being used to create the surveillance state. Now, it should be noted that the league ultimately ended its academy program, and they did an investigation into the wake of our reporting, frankly, and then ultimately said the centers didn't meet our standards, and they closed.
How have Joe Tsai and Alibaba responded to the allegations, Mark, that their investment, their money in these companies has therefore made them supportive of these violations of human rights in China?
Our understanding is that, you know, this is from a source who's close to Tsai, that Alibaba grew concerned after Megvii and SenseTime were placed on the entity list. One of the things that they did was to make sure that they did not hold board seats in the company and effectively were not in a position to be making decisions and not at all directly involved in operations. They also sought assurance from the two companies that they weren't targeting Uyghurs. Another move they made was to choose not to divest, which is, you know, there's a question, well, okay, well, if you're feeling this way, why not divest from the companies if you're worried?
Right.
But I think there was a sense that there was a responsibility to shareholders, according to the source. And again, that Alibaba was just this passive investor. They ultimately own 30% of Megvii and 7% of SenseTime. But those investments are made prior to the companies being named on the blacklist.
Mark, just to be very clear here, how explicit, how obvious is it that this technology is being used to surveil Uyghurs in this way?
So there's been reporting by a range of folks from the New York Times, the Washington Post, human rights organizations, an entity out of Australia that has assessed the surveillance networks in China, that's indicated and found coding to prove and show that Megvii and SenseTime were indeed racially profiling and identifying the Uyghur population. As well, there's another company that's worked in tandem with some of those entities called IPVM. They're a surveillance industry research firm. In addition to them revealing evidence about Megvii and SenseTime, they also reported that there was an Alibaba-connected website that actually had instructions on how to use software to identify Uyghurs.
Mm.
So this is the way that the technology has been used. And that's just a single example of the ways in which Tsai and the NBA find themselves in this really complicated and difficult situation with China.
Coming up, the behind-the-scenes story of the tweet that showed all of us how complicated that entire situation really is.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine. especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So, Mark, it's worth pointing out that the NBA's business in China goes back over 30 years now. And so how did the NBA first develop a business relationship there? How has it grown in those past three decades?
It's a pretty interesting tale. I mean, back in the late 80s, David Stern, then the commissioner, wants to get into China. I mean, he sees the potential for growth for the NBA. Basketball is this very popular sport there, and he sees an opportunity. And so he goes to China, and he's essentially carrying a stack of VCR tapes, as I understand it, has been reported previously. And he takes them to television executives there and says, look, we'll give you clips like once a week and highlight reels and just play them here. And we'll strike some sort of relationship. And that's the growth and the birth of the NBA in China. And it happens in the late 80s. By 2008, the NBA is now engrossed enough in China that it creates its own separate entity, which is called NBA China. And it is a major investor. Obviously, the league is and all the teams. And then there are a few separate investors in NBA China that come on at that time, one of which, and the highest investor, is actually ESPN.
Yes.
ESPN has a 5% stake in NBA China. The estimates now are that NBA China, after starting with David Stern showing up with VCR tapes, is now worth $5 billion.
Man.
That's the valuation on it.
And so now the NBA's business in China is a multi-billion dollar asset to be protected. Mark, it's a priority, which brings us to the thing that happened just 2 months after Joe Tsai became the owner of the Nets.
The National Basketball Association, or NBA, in the U.S., it's facing a huge backlash from U.S. lawmakers for its reaction to this tweet by the Houston Rockets general manager, a tweet backing pro-democracy demonstrations right here in Hong Kong.
So Daryl Morey is the general manager of the Houston Rockets when this is happening. And he tweets out this graphic, Mark, a now infamous graphic that says, quote, fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong, end quote, in support of anti-government protests that are going on in Hong Kong, protests that came in response to a law that allowed for extradition from Hong Kong back to mainland China by the government. And it led to these violent clashes between protesters and police. How did Joe Tsai respond to Morey's tweet in specific?
So, you know, the tweet had elicited much anger in China, and Tsai was beginning to see this and recognize it. The league was grappling with how to respond, and Tsai believed that he needed to step forward. And so he was actually getting ready to leave for China to attend some exhibition games there when the Morey tweet happened. Tsai is watching all this play out, and he gets contacted by the deputy commissioner, Mark Tatum, who oversees international for the NBA. Tatum informs Tsai that this is turning into a big issue and we have a problem.
Mm.
So one of the things that Tsai views himself as, partly because of his connections to sports, partly because his life has sort of bridged China and the U.S., is a guy who can sort of somehow be in the middle and bridge these relationships. He writes this open letter. He gives effectively a history lesson in which he tries to explain, at least in his mind, why the Chinese would be so upset that Daryl Morey has hit a third rail issue. And he inaccurately portrays Morey as having supported an effort to separate Hong Kong from China, a separatist movement, which was not, in fact, what Morey was supporting. But this is what Tsai crafted, and that's what he posted on Facebook from his private plane.
By the way, I know Daryl Morey. He's been on the show numerous times. To be very clear, I have not talked to him about the reporting in your story, Mark. But Daryl publicly is indicating that he is supporting democracy. Joe Tsai is invoking separatism, which is a fear that is definitely real on the Chinese mainland. How did the league respond to all of this, to Morey's tweet and to Joe Tsai's letter in response?
The NBA initially issues a statement in which it says Morey's tweet clearly has deeply offended its fans in China, and they call that fact regrettable. The statement from the league also notes its support for individuals sharing their own views. There's a translation of that statement that comes out in China that seems to translate in a much more, even more generous way towards the Chinese and trying to placate them. That creates its own level of controversy because here in the States, the league suddenly gets attacked by politicians from both sides of the aisle.
Republican Senator Marco Rubio summed it up this way, saying NBA players have no problem speaking out on politics and social issues in America, but they apologize to China for a pro-democracy tweet. And Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell tweeted, "Listen, some things are more important than money, like doing the right thing."
So now you've got this dynamic in which Morey's being attacked, Tsai is responding in the way he's responding, and the league is trying to find some middle ground here or figure out how it can exist, even as two exhibition games are about to be played in China. And part of our reporting points out that behind the scenes, though Tsai and the NBA deny this vehemently, behind the scenes, Tsai was seeking to get Morey fired.
Well, Mark, this part, the backstage negotiations that you're reporting here, that I need you to explain more, because as messy as the public-facing aspect of this is, what was happening quietly speaks to what seems to really be the story of how delicate all of this is.
So one of the things that's going on is our reporting shows that Morey hears from at least one NBA owner that Tsai is trying to get him fired in order to appease the Chinese. Morey ends up connecting with a guy named Matt Turpin, who had worked for the NSC in the Trump administration.
The National Security Council.
Yes, thank you. And Turpin and a couple others volunteer to help Morey, who believes he's going to get fired. And one of the things Turpin tells us as he's working back channels, both in the government and through the NBA, is that he said, quote, "My impression of Joe Tsai's role in this was it was extremely unhelpful. He was laying out to the other owners how completely unacceptable it was that anyone weigh in on Hong Kong. And it colored the way the rest of the league lined up against Daryl." And again, I want to say the league and the Nets both strongly denied that Tsai intervened in any way, that he sought there to be an apology or any of those things. And so this is all what's starting to go on behind the scenes. And you're ending up with DC involved in its own way. You're ending up with the NBA grappling in China with how to respond to it. And you've got Morey literally worrying about whether he's going to lose his job.
And when you mention that the league, as per Turpin, began to line up against Daryl Morey, I mean, it was hard to avoid that impression, Mark, when the king weighs in.
Right. I mean, I don't think people knew this at the time. There are these games that are about to be played in Shanghai. And one of the teams that's there to play is the Lakers. So LeBron's there, of course. And obviously, there's this just, again, an international incident happening in real time in front of these guys. And there are meetings that happen between the players and the commissioner, as well as the players themselves. LeBron has got his new movie Space Jam about to open. It's in production. The hope at the time, at least, was that it was going to open in China.
Mm.
And so behind closed doors, the players are meeting and saying, how do we deal with this? What are they going to do? And LeBron was quite vocal in raging about Morey and how something needed to happen to Morey. It's not till later that this becomes an issue when James returns to the States and LeBron famously says Morey was, quote, misinformed about his opinion in Hong Kong.
I don't want to get into a word or sentence feud with Daryl. Morey, but I believe he wasn't educated on the situation at hand, and he spoke, and so many people could have been harmed, not only financially but physically, emotionally, spiritually.
And that creates a whole another series of issues.
So just be careful what we tweet and we say, and what we do, even though, yes, we do have freedom of speech, but there can be a lot of negative that comes with that, too.
Yeah, it sounded like LeBron, to be very blunt about this, was telling Daryl Morey to shut up and manage the salary cap.
You saw James, as a result, getting hammered on both sides, politically and otherwise, for those statements.
And that tweet, Mark, how ultimately did that affect Daryl Morey's career, his fortunes in the NBA, and also like the NBA's literal fortunes, their business in China?
Well, Morey ultimately keeps his job. So he moves on. The league, however, is not so readily able to move on. They're banned from state TV for most of the next three seasons. And the league, basically, it costs them hundreds of millions of dollars, as well as the goodwill they build up with China for years. There's an entity called Tencent, which is this technology giant that streams NBA games there. And in fact, we at ESPN have our own partnership with Tencent. And after the Morey tweet, the Rockets end up entirely off of Tencent. The Rockets had been the most popular team in China, and suddenly they're disappeared from streaming content. They don't even exist. And then when Morey leaves Houston to go to the 76ers, suddenly the 76ers are disappeared. And then this happens again earlier this year when Enes Kanter freed him. Then he's with the Celtics. He calls China's president a brutal dictator. And the next thing you know, Celtics games are off 10 cents.
Developing this morning, China pulling the broadcast of the Boston Celtics season opening game after center Enes Kanter criticized Beijing for its treatment of Tibet and called President Xi a dictator.
This is a lasting issue for the league. Games have most recently actually returned to CCTV, and we'll see how long-term that is.
You know, one of the reasons, Mark, that this story is so politically bountiful, why it's so attractive to both sides of the aisle here, is because of how the NBA has also branded itself and how Adam Silver, its commissioner, has become one of the most progressive commissioners we have ever seen in global sports, certainly when it comes to domestic human rights issues here in America. But what has Adam Silver said publicly about Daryl's tweet and about these issues where the U.S. and China, that mess seems almost unavoidable?
You know, the first thing I should say is that the commissioner declined to be interviewed for our story. They did issue a statement to us, the league did, in which Silver said, "We've always supported and will continue to support every member of the NBA family, including Daryl Morey and Enes Freedom, expressing their personal views on social and political issues." But that's not really saying a lot, right? And in fact, you know, when we did the story we discussed earlier about the league's training academies, we interviewed Mark Tatum, the deputy commissioner. They had closed this facility in Xinjiang. And we're like, okay, well, why? What role did human rights play in this? And Tatum repeatedly avoided the question like the plague. He did not want any part of having to address not only whether human rights issues had played a role in closing the facility, but whether they existed at all. It was just not something they were going to be comfortable talking about.
After the break, what Joe Tsai has said about democratic freedoms on the record and how it differs when talking about China versus the United States.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
We mentioned at the top of the show, Mark, that Joe Tsai has been openly supportive of China and the Chinese government. Can you walk us through some examples of those public displays of support?
Sure. This was actually some of the most fascinating part of the reporting to us, I think. We scoured the web to find every possible time that Tsai had publicly said anything. And so we listened to hours of him talking. The more you found, the more clear it became his explanations of where China was and the decisions they were making. And they were quite startling sort of in the way they were acknowledged. So, for example, when he's asked about sort of the limits on academic freedoms and a crackdown on dissent and those kinds of things, at one point he says, look, it is what it is.
It is what it is. The fact is China today is a single party system. So there's going to be restrictions on academic freedoms and freedom of expression. Do people like that? I think most people don't like it.
For sure.
But I think that's how the party, the Communist Party, needs to control that in order to feel confident about pushing all their policies in other areas. They feel that dissent has to take a back seat, mm-hmm. and whatever they're doing is right.
And that's the part of dealing with a single party system that's necessary in China. It's quite obviously pretty controversial position. This is again why, we found it fascinating. I mean, there's a point, Tsai's at a panel discussion at the Milken Institute in 2018, and he just says it flat out. You need to understand it's important for the communist government that there's absolute stability in the country.
In the American context, we talk about freedom of speech, freedom of press, but in the China context, not having being able to restrict some of those freedoms is an important element to keep the stability.
What would be accurate to say about Tsai in his position is that he believes 80-90%, he said this at one point, 80-90% of the country feel like their lives are improving every year. And that the position is that that should be the goal of a country, that economic stability should be the goal, and that if in the name of that economic stability, we've got to limit some freedoms like freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom to dissent, then so be it.
Yeah, you just don't hear in such blunt language a rejection of democracy. And it's a rejection of democracy, by the way, Mark, that comes in contrast to Joe Tsai's stance on social justice and democracy here in America, right?
Yeah, I mean, very much so. I mean, you know, here's a guy, he and his wife, Clara Wu Tsai, they've donated hundreds of millions of dollars to social justice initiatives and in the academic world. I mean, the Barclays Center became sort of a central spot, a gathering spot in the Black Lives Matter movement. And Tsai embraced that. He wanted it to be that. And he very much believes in that. They've also spent millions of dollars on creating an anti-Asia hate entity. They've created a social justice fund. They've raised just hundreds of millions of dollars towards these kinds of social justice issues in the States.
Yes.
And so I think to people who are critical of Tsai about his positions in China, this is the contrast that they point out. Like, how can somebody be this aggressively supportive of social justice issues in America and be much more circumspect about those issues in China?
Yeah, they've been very outspoken against hate crimes against Asian Americans, something both of us, I think, can understand the importance of. They've donated masks and ventilators, thousands of them during the pandemic in the city of New York. But the sort of untenable awkwardness of this balance, Mark. I mean, clearly Joe Tsai is doing what he can to appease governments and constituencies in two very different countries, the U.S. and China. What options, I suppose, does he really have here?
You know, I don't really know. I think this is the dilemma the league and he face, and any of the owners, about how to deal with China. And frankly, they're not alone, right? There's plenty of other companies that face these issues, including our own ESPN, yes, as well as its partner, yeah, Walt Disney Company, in extreme ways, as we pointed out in the story. So, you know, what I can tell you is Tsai declined to be interviewed for the story. We had a person quoted in the story saying Joe Tsai could resign from Alibaba, for example, which certainly he could do. But I think he's in a position in which here's a very profitable company. They have shareholders to answer to. And Tsai believes in working this system and believes that, you know, I think this is the important piece too. He believes, based on what we've been told, that because of the unique position he has, both from his background and financial status as a co-founder of Alibaba and as an owner of the Nets, that he can somehow bridge these two worlds into a better place.
So at the very end here, Mark, as we try to look ahead to how the NBA's investment and involvement in China might go from here, and how honestly, like, not just Joe Tsai, but the other owners in the league might proceed from here, what's your forecast looking like?
I mean, in some ways, it's more dependent on China than it is on the NBA. I think the league is in this really difficult position, right, of trying to balance its own interests financially and otherwise with its commitment to social justice while dealing with increasing awareness around the allegations about China's human rights abuses. And again, this is not just a Tsai problem and it's not an overall NBA problem. Many of the other NBA owners have financial investments and exposure in China.
Mm.
The Heat's owner, Mickey Arison, is the chairman of Carnival Cruise Lines. So Carnival is enormous in China. Michael Jordan, of course, burns millions of dollars to Nike's business in China. Nike was identified as having some connection to Xinjiang. So many owners have these issues and connections. And I think, you know, it's creating this really awkward dance for the NBA in which you've got owners and players who are very vocal and active here in the U.S. about social justice issues, but effectively avoiding the topic with China. Again, this is a $5 billion entity for the NBA. That makes life very difficult as they try to navigate this.
Mark Fanyaruwada, thank you so much for your reporting.
Pablo, I really appreciate you spending the time. Thanks a lot.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. And before I let you go here, did want to share a bit of good news on the personal front for us, because ESPN Daily happens to be up for a Webby Award for Best Sports Podcast. So if you listen to this show and you love it like we hope you do, please take a minute to vote. If you could, there's a link on my Twitter account. It's very easy to access at Pablo Torre, or you can go to vote.webbyawards.com and just search for ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.